You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Letter from the Swamp by Emily Jane Fox. The Counselor, the epiphany that led Michael Cohen, Trump's disgraced former lawyer, to a public triumph. In the illustration, Cohen is shown testifying recently. For much of the 2 weeks preceding his public appearance on Capitol Hill on February 27th, Michael Cohen sat in his Park Avenue apartment with a legal pad and pen in his hands as he tried to formulate his opening statement. Naturally, it was hard to focus. Cohen's hearing before the House Committee on Oversight and Reform would be broadcast live on television and streamed over the Internet, essentially blanketing all other news events across the country, including President Donald Trump's crucial meeting in Hanoi with North Korean strongman Kim Jong-un. Democrats would ask him uncomfortable and embarrassing questions about actions he undertook on the president's behalf. Republicans, meanwhile, would portray him as disloyal, a person of vanishing credibility with a rancid agenda. It was befitting these odd political times, a made-for-TV moment, and the public's enthusiasm for the showdown, as with many of the interstitial episodes of the Russian investigation, was approaching Super Bowl-like hysteria. As he jotted on the legal pad, the anticipation had already begun. Cohen would occasionally hear his name invoked on the television, repeated with increasing frequency. Eventually, he settled on remarks close to the scathing rebuke of Trump, his former boss, that he would deliver on that late February morning. The president, he would say, was a crook, a cheat, a liar, and a racist, who orchestrated a hush money scheme in the run-up to the 2016 election, inflated his wealth, and had advanced knowledge of a WikiLeaks plot to release stolen emails about Hillary Clinton. Cohen passed what he figured would be his final draft to his legal team. It was eviscerating, they thought. It also struck the right tone and presented a damning first-person perspective on Cohen's 10 years in Trump's employ. But, his lawyers cautioned, Republicans on the committee would be looking for any opportunity to poke holes in his story. Cohen had already pleaded guilty to 9 criminal counts, including campaign finance violations, financial crimes, and, perhaps most important, lying to Congress. They would relentlessly attack his credibility and discount his personal anecdotes without documentary evidence of Trump's alleged misdeeds. It was around this point that Cohen saw a congressman on cable news discussing Trump's financials, and he remembered that he had some of those documents in his possession. Federal agents had seized them from his former office in Rockefeller Center last April as part of a criminal investigation by the Southern District of New York. The boxes they had returned were now in a storage unit in the basement of his Trump-branded building, incidentally, the same tower where Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner keep an apartment. So he went down to look. About 9 boxes were there waiting for him, so Cohen began rummaging through them. The first contained a bunch of junk. The second did, too. Then there was the third. Oh, my God, he said when he opened it. He'd hit the mother lode. Inside were 3 years of Trump's financial statements, from 2011 through 2013, which Cohen would later point out to the Committee on Oversight and Reform as evidence that the president had purposefully inflated or deflated his personal assets when it suited him, to secure bank loans or land a higher spot on the Forbes 400 list, for instance, or to lower his tax liability. There were also countless personal notes from Trump, scrawled across newspaper clippings, printed articles, and torn out pages from glossy magazines. One note, written in Sharpie across an unflattering article, urged Cohen to call a reporter and threaten him with a lawsuit. Another note, on a story prominently featuring Cohen, read simply, "Michael, enjoy this while it lasts." Other documents were potentially more damaging, such as an email exchange with Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg, whose name came up almost as often as Trump's in the House hearing. The correspondence regarded the reimbursement that Cohen received for the $130,000 payment he made to adult film actress Stormy Daniels 13 days before the election in order to keep her from going public with allegations of an affair with Trump. In his testimony before the Oversight Committee, Cohen alleged that Trump and Weisselberg had direct knowledge of the negotiations leading up to the payment, and, according to Cohen, a plan to reimburse him in 11 installments. He told the committee that upon visiting Trump in the Oval Office in early 2017, the president brought up the reimbursements. "The checks were on their way," Trump said, "but had been delayed because it took time for his personal correspondence to make its way through the White House mailroom." Cohen went back to the bank where he had deposited the series of checks. 2 days before he was set to deliver his open testimony, he had a copy of one written in August 2017, 6 months into Trump's presidency, for $35,000 from Trump's personal bank account. It was marked with Trump's unmistakable signature. The next day, as Cohen spent nearly 10 hours behind closed doors testifying in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, another check came through from the bank. This one bore the signatures of Donald Trump Jr. and Weisselberg. The following day, Cohen presented the House committee with slides of the checks, financial documents, and other papers he had found in the boxes, and that, he felt, spoke to the president's character. The slides were shown in the hearing room and broadcast around the world. Cohen's opening statement ran about half an hour and kicked off a grueling 5-hour congressional root canal into his knowledge of Trump's business dealings with Moscow, a phone call between Trump and Roger Stone regarding WikiLeaks, how Trump manipulated the value of his assets, and all the legal threats and payment schemes Cohen facilitated in order to quash stories about everything from Trump's SAT scores to his alleged mistresses. Cohen remained largely stoic as he recounted again and again that he is, indeed, guilty of multiple crimes, but that he is full of remorse and will be paying the price when he reports to prison on May 6th to begin his 3-year sentence. He teared up once during Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings' closing statement. Cummings brought up a photograph the congressman said had pained him, an image of Cohen walking with his daughter, who was using a crutch while she recovered from hip surgery as he left his sentencing hearing in December. By that evening, Cohen was back in his hotel room, exhausted. His lawyers were trying to prepare him for his final closed-door session on the Hill the following morning, but he was overwhelmed. His phone buzzed and rang off the hook. Friends checked in. Reporters called, asking for juice. Everyone wanted to weigh in on how they thought he'd done that day. Cohen felt he had accomplished what he needed to do, he told them, and was relieved to have it over with. After his final hearing, Cohen headed back to New York for 2 months at home before reporting to prison. He has affairs to get in order. He wants to spend as much time with his family as he can. There's also unsettled Trump business. As he made clear at the hearing, Cohen is still participating with investigators in ongoing inquiries out of the Southern District of New York, which many in Trump's inner circle agree poses the most dangerous threat to the president, his business, and his family, a point Cohen underscored in front of the committee. Is there any other wrongdoing or illegal act that you are aware of regarding Donald Trump that we haven't yet discussed today? Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy asked him. Yes, Cohen responded. Those are part of the investigation that's currently being looked at by the Southern District of New York. Modern Romance by Gabriel Sherman. Romeo and Juliet and Jeff. The star-crossed, politicized, complexified romance of the world's richest man. Opening illustration by Philip Burke of The Happy Couple. Improbably, given all that's happened, they're still together. There are any number of people or entities that have been accused of trying to tear Jeff Bezos and Lauren Sanchez asunder. Donald Trump, the Saudis, David Pecker, Bezos' longtime private security consultant, Gavin DeBecker, William Morris, Endeavor co-CEO Patrick Weitzel, Lauren Sanchez's husband, and her brother Michael, who who's been accused of leaking Bezos' intimate text to the National Enquirer. "I love you, alive girl. I will show you with my body and my lips and my eyes very soon," Bezos wrote. But according to some, Bezos and Sanchez are as close as they've ever been. "It's a legendary romance that will blow your mind as to just how in love they are," Michael told me last month. "It's real," said another source close to the couple. In the days after the Enquirer splashed their affair on its issue that hit the stands on January 10th, Bezos and Sanchez stayed apart, but they didn't split up. They discussed meeting on January 18th, when Bezos accepted an aviation award in Beverly Hills, a source close to the couple told me. Flying has been central to their romance, but the date didn't happen. The New York Post, page 6, reported that they had a secret reunion in Manhattan around Valentine's Day and talked about attending the Oscars together, but Bezos ultimately went to the Vanity Fair party without Lauren. Patrick Weitzel was also on hand. "He was very relaxed," said someone who talked to him. Bezos declined to comment. Sanchez didn't respond to an email seeking comment. No matter what else happens, the situation has all the hallmarks of a Trump-era scandal. Absurd and darkly lurid and completely overdrawn, with a cast of characters both super powerful and ridiculous, and with enormous political and journalistic stakes, not to mention the midlife crisis of the world's richest man. Bezos has transformed markedly in the last few years, shaving the last wisp of hair from his head, upscaling his wardrobe, and developing impressive biceps. He's acquired mogul-appropriate toys and hobbies, including owning the Washington Post and space tourism company Blue Origin. In a February speech, he proclaimed his goal to colonize the solar system with 1 trillion human beings. Bezos has always taken pride in his boldness, and the Medium essay he published 4 weeks after the Enquirer story was in line with some of his business maneuvers, a jiu-jitsu move whereby he flipped his script from unfaithful cad to upholder of the highest values, standing up to a blackmail attempt by a well-known bully at great personal risk. "My ownership of the Washington Post is a complexifier," Bezos wrote. It's unavoidable that certain powerful people who experience Washington Post news coverage will wrongly conclude, "I am their enemy." He accused the Enquirer of publishing the article about his affair as a favor to Trump and Saudi Arabia. Bezos' evidence came from emails from the Enquirer's parent company, American Media Incorporated, threatening to release intimate photographs unless his people stopped saying the Enquirer was motivated by politics, and issued a statement insisting there was no basis for the suggestion. Since the Medium post, the Bezos side has doubled down on this position. A source close to Bezos told me that De Becker is preparing a 90-page investigative report that will make the case that the Enquirer published the Bezos expose to curry favor with Saudi investors. AMI reportedly lost $72 million last year, and the Enquirer's circulation fell 18% to about 265,000. In January, the company announced it had raised $460 million to refinance its crushing debt load. The theory is that Saudi Arabia, either directly or indirectly, bailed out AMI as a reward for humiliating an enemy of the regime. De Becker declined to comment. AMI has ample reason to dispute Bezos' charges, whatever the underlying truth. Pecker has a long-standing relationship with Trump, and the company is entangled in the Stormy Daniels case. If De Becker's claims are true, Pecker could be in violation of a non-prosecution agreement with prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. So it makes sense that AMI is taking the position that the article was an ordinary gossip story with no political motives, paying sources handsomely to drop dimes. A person close to AMI said the source was Michael Sanchez. This person, who says they viewed Michael's communications with the Inquirer, told me AMI paid Michael $250,000 for Bezos' text and more than a dozen dick pics. Inquirer editor Dylan Howard told DeBecker in a phone call that the Inquirer paid a lot for the Bezos story, according to a person briefed on the conversation. Until Bezos accused AMI of extortion, Michael was known as a minor player hustling for scraps on the margins of the entertainment industry. He had worked at ICM and MTV before becoming a talent manager and publicist, and his biggest client seemed to be his sister, a former television host turned helicopter entrepreneur who is married to WME co-CEO Patrick Weitzel. Michael strenuously denied leaking the photos, but was less declarative when I asked about the text. "I'm not saying I didn't do something," Michael told me early in February. "Until I go under oath, what I can tell you now is that ever since April 20th, when I met Jeff, my only goal has been to protect Jeff and Lauren." Michael is trying to have it multiple ways. He claims not to be responsible for the worst of the leaks. But neither are the Saudis, and AMI's not so bad either. Michael mainly wants to cast blame on DeBecker, whom he accuses of exerting control over Bezos' personal life. Lauren calls it a cockfight, Michael has told me, but Michael's protestations that he has been acting only in the service of a great love story is hard to credit, given that for the Inquirer story he may have done something. Michael insists that he loves Jeff and wants his sister's relationship to succeed. Over the last year, he maintains, he served as an unofficial advisor to the couple. "I believe their passion for flying is so sincere and so earnest," he said. "It was Bezos," Michael continued, "who made the first move." When Jeff made the first pass, Lauren was like, "What are you doing? We're just friends. We're pilots." The couple discussed with Michael what would happen if their love affair leaked, Michael said. "The three of us had discussed before that at some point this was going to be a scandal. My advice was, let's get to the other side. Our analogy was always that they were landing a 747. I told them, you're both pilots, and you've never landed a 747, but that's what we're trying to do here." When the Inquirer called Bezos and Sanchez for comment in early January, Michael says, he and the couple even discussed the notion of Bezos buying AMI, the ultimate potential catch and kill. Michael told me that Bezos and DeBecker are framing the scandal as a pro-Trump political hit job to distract from a far simpler story. Bezos cheated on his wife, and DeBecker's security apparatus couldn't prevent Bezos from being caught. "The whole Saudi Arabia thing is going to explode in Gavin's face," Michael said. He added that DeBecker's judgment is clouded because he has been trying to break up Sanchez and Bezos to protect Bezos' wife, Mackenzie, a close DeBecker friend. Sanchez says DeBecker told Bezos to agree to a 30-day physical separation from Sanchez and encouraged Bezos and Mackenzie to undergo couples therapy with celebrity therapist Ray and Judy of Maui Intensives Incorporated. "Once Judy and Ray were hired," Michael said to me, "I told Lauren, watch out, we're effed. Gavin is going to get Jeff back together with Mackenzie." In a series of interviews, Michael insisted Trump had no involvement in the leak of the affair. "I've never spoken to Trump," he said, adding that he is only casual friends with Roger Stone. Carter Page is a client, but on Twitter, Michael is an enthusiastic Trump supporter, and it's evident Trump is thrilled by Bezos' woes. Ultimately, federal prosecutors will play a role in determining whether Bezos is a victim of blackmail and a political smear, or merely an unfaithful spouse trying to distract from the fact that he was caught cheating. And what better way to prove that love is true than a leak of intimate text and photographs to the National Enquirer and a federal investigation? And on one point, everyone can agree. At the end of this, we're all going to look really, really bad, Michael said. Now, here's this month's cover story Beto's choice. Beto O'Rourke seemed to come from nowhere to the brink of a presidential candidacy, but he's been on a journey for his whole life, from El Paso and rebellion against a domineering political father, through Columbia, Williamsburg, punk rock, and the World Wide Web. Joe Hagan traces his winding path and asks if O'Rourke could become America's first punk president. Photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, campaign stop. Beto O'Rourke, photographed with son Henry, 8, and Artemis, at his home in El Paso, Texas. It's 9 p.m. on a Thursday night, and Beto O'Rourke is trying to manage a couple of life-altering and possibly world-historical political events while also driving his family home from a Mexican restaurant. Donald Trump will touch down in O'Rourke's hometown of El Paso in 4 days to hold a rally and whip up excitement for a wall along the border with Mexico. O'Rourke's iPhone is pinging with text, asking what he plans to do about it, and also whether he's going to run for President of the United States of America. Henry, age 8, weighs in from the back of the Toyota Tundra. "Dad, if you run for president, I'm going to cry all day," he says. "Just the one day?" asks O'Rourke, hopefully. "Every day," says Henry. Daughter Molly, freckle-faced and clever, astutely observes, "The White House is going to be all wet." Earlier that day, the 10-year-old declared cheerily, "I want to live in the White House." O'Rourke's eldest, 12-year-old Ulysses, named for the hero of the Homeric classic that Beto O'Rourke has said he cherishes, delivers the final word, "I only want you to run if you're going to win." For a potential presidential candidate, Trump's visit is a gift, but one that could easily be bobbled or squandered. O'Rourke is trying to organize a counter-rally, but he is meeting stiff resistance from local activists whose big idea is to stage a protest outside Trump's rally. "They're insisting on their event. They just want us to come in and support," he tells me. O'Rourke thinks a protest is exactly wrong and would play right into Trump's hands. "I gotta think, what does his team want?" he says of Trump. "What are they expecting us to do?" Some calculation went into this. So, is that what they're looking for? Characteristically, O'Rourke wants a more optimistic approach, one that doesn't let the president define the terms. And so he'll spend the next 24 hours carefully steering allies to his idea of staging an upbeat March for Truth, which would just happen to star El Paso's best counterargument to Donald Trump himself. And it will all work out, if he can just keep his eyes on the road. "MFs," he says after darting into a busy intersection while ferrying the brood home from school that day. Then he catches himself. "Sorry, kids." Beto O'Rourke's mission-style home in the El Paso neighborhood of Sunset Heights is the site of a famous 1915 meeting between Mexican revolutionary Pancho Villa and U.S. General Hugh Scott. While renovating it, O'Rourke had a wrought iron fence around the property removed, save for a few feet of it around a pistachio tree. In late February, he came home to find Republican protesters live-streaming video and asking why he still had a fence, mimicking Trump's remark that politicians like walls when they're around their own homes. I said, "Come up with me, and I will take you to our front door," he recalls. "This is just decorative fencing." "Why do you have walls in your house?" they retorted. "Why do you have a door?" Behind the door in the O'Rourke living room, a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf contains a section for rock memoirs, Bob Dylan's Chronicles, a favorite, and a stack of LPs, The Clash, Nina Simone, but also a sizable collection of presidential biographies, including Robert Caro's work on Lyndon B. Johnson. Arranged in historical order, The biographies suggest there's been some reflection on the gravity of the presidency, but there's also some political poetry to it, a sense that O'Rourke might be destined for this shelf. He has an aura. Most places he goes in El Paso, he's dogged by cries of Beto, Beto. Oprah Winfrey, who helped anoint Barack Obama in 2008, practically begged him to run at an event in New York City at the beginning of February. Settling into an armchair in his living room, he tries to make sense of his rise. "I honestly don't know how much of it was me," he says, "but there was something abnormal, supernormal, or I don't know what the hell to call it, that we both experience when we're out on the campaign trail." O'Rourke and his wife, Amy, an educator 9 years his junior, both describe the moment they first witnessed the power of O'Rourke's gift. It was in Houston, the third stop on O'Rourke's 2-year Senate campaign against Ted Cruz. Every seat was taken, every wall, every space in the room was filled with probably 1,000 people, recalls Amy O'Rourke. You could feel the floor moving almost. It was not totally clear that Beto was what everybody was looking for, but just like that people were so ready for something. So that was totally shocking. I mean, like, took my breath away shocking. For O'Rourke, what followed was a near mystical experience. "I don't ever prepare a speech," he says. "I don't write out what I'm going to say. I remember driving to that, I was like, what do I say? Maybe I'll just introduce myself. I'll take questions." I got in there, and I don't know if it's a speech or not, but it felt amazing, because every word was pulled out of me, like by some greater force, which was just the people there. Everything that I said, I was like watching myself, being like, how am I saying this stuff? Where is this coming from? "There's something that happens to me," he says, "or that I get to be a part of in those rooms that is not like normal life. I don't know if that has ever happened to me before. I don't know if that would happen again." At 46, O'Rourke is only a couple of years younger than former rival Ted Cruz. But part of the excitement and the content of his potential candidacy is generational. Whereas Obama is from the tail end of the baby boom, Beto O'Rourke is quintessentially Generation X, weaned on Star Wars and punk rock, and priding himself on authenticity over showmanship. And a healthy skepticism of the mainstream. He came of age in a world of crumbling taboos over personal revelation, which has clearly peaked with Donald Trump, whose relentless Twitter habit has basically set the table for O'Rourke's open book style. Whether on stage or on Facebook Live or in person, O'Rourke has a preternatural ease. That openness is part of what he loves about campaigning. "I think that's the beauty of elections. You can't hide from who you are," he says. "The more honestly and directly you communicate to people why you're doing this, the way in which you want to serve them, I just think that the better, more informed decision that they can make." Next photo, driving force, O'Rourke on the road outside of El Paso. If the message is honesty, the medium is patently social media. O'Rourke speaks admiringly of Bronx-born Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, with whom he shares some overlapping political convictions, but also a talent for the sort of viral disclosures and vignettes delivered on Twitter or Instagram that are disrupting national politics. "She does not seem to me to be afraid of making a mistake or not saying it perfectly," he says, "and in the process says the most important, I think some of the most important things anyone can be talking about right now, and she's freed herself from fear." A candidate of honesty and basic decency, a la Jimmy Carter, is in high demand among a lot of Democrats looking for optimal results in 2020. as is that sense of generational shift that powered Democratic campaigns dating back to John F. Kennedy, whose Profiles in Courage is in O'Rourke's library. But O'Rourke's radical openness can also look like naivete, as with his Instagrammed teeth cleaning, which was quickly clipped. Isolated from its context and made to look ridiculous, skeptics question whether O'Rourke's political transcendentalism can sustain the meat grinder of a national election. In a Democratic primary, he will not have the bogeyman of a Trump or a Cruz from which to draw voter energy. He is decidedly not the street fighter many Democrats crave. And in a zero-sum world, his astounding run against Ted Cruz in last year's Texas Senate race, historic as it was still a loss. O'Rourke is acutely aware, too, of perhaps his biggest vulnerability, being a white man in a Democratic Party yearning for a woman or a person of color. A Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker. The government at all levels is overly represented by white men, he says. That's part of the problem, and I'm a white man. So if I were to run, I think it's just so important that those who would comprise my team looked like this country. If I were to run, if I were to win, that my administration looks like this country. It's the only way I know to meet that challenge. But I totally understand people who will make a decision based on the fact that almost every single one of our presidents has been a white man, and they want something different for this country. And I think that's a very legitimate basis upon which to make a decision. Especially in the fact that there are some really great candidates out there right now. Next photo, trail mix. O'Rourke with daughter Molly, 10, son Ulysses, 12, wife Amy, and Henry at Franklin Mountains State Park in El Paso. O'Rourke is careful to pay homage to progressive icons, crediting Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren with advancing the national conversation on health care and consumer protections, but sells himself as something slightly different, a youthful uniter, willing to listen and learn from the most recalcitrant right-wing voters and work with Republicans. If I bring something to this, he says, I think it is my ability to listen to people, to help bring people together, to do something that is thought to be impossible. My sense is, following some success that I had in Congress and working with Republicans to actually get things signed into law, including both President Obama and President Trump's administrations, that I may have an ability to work with people who think differently than I do, come to a different conclusion that I've come to on a given issue, and yet find enough common ground to do something better than what we have right now. A few days before Trump arrives, while meeting with students at the University of Texas at El Paso, O'Rourke compares the battle against Trump to every epic movie that you have ever seen, from Star Wars to The Lord of the Rings. This is the moment where we're going to win or lose everything. O'Rourke likes to think in such mythic terms. As he quipped on the campaign trail, he named his son Ulysses because I didn't have the balls to call him Odysseus. But in a private meeting with Barack Obama last November, the former president had asked Beto O'Rourke to consider if he had a clear path to the White House. Could he deliver Texas, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin? I don't have a team counting delegates, O'Rourke says, again invoking a politics not readily accessible by reason. Almost no one thought there was a path in Texas, and I just knew it. I just felt it. I knew it was there, and I knew that with enough work and enough creativity and enough amazing people, if I'm able to meet them and bring them in, then we can do it. That's how I feel about this, he says. It's probably not the most professional thing you've ever heard about this, but I just feel it. After dueling rallies in El Paso last February, O'Rourke's March for Truth versus Trump's Finish the Wall, Trump was quick to declare his crowd sizes larger and deem O'Rourke an unworthy failure. But Trump's choice of El Paso for a rally had already created a storyline, giving new relevance to O'Rourke and his ideas. His vision of the border, and for America too, is rooted in the El Paso he grew up in. Before 9/11, the Texas border with Mexico was essentially open. In 1986, his father, Pat O'Rourke, an El Paso politician, told Bill Moyers on CBS, "When I was 6 and 7 years old, I didn't know I wasn't a Mexican. When I was a kid, I'd get on the streetcar and go to Juarez and go to the cine, the movie, over there. That's my community. These people are my friends. They're my neighbors." Nowadays, Beto O'Rourke seems to have embraced his father's local globalism, but he spent much of his youth trying to escape the influence and legacy of Pat O'Rourke before returning home to embrace his heritage and redeem his father's political failures. When I first met O'Rourke, he showed me a framed snapshot of his father standing atop a mesa, a denim-wearing Southwesterner who looked a bit like Jimmy Buffett, bald with blonde locks and a wild man grin. An avid outdoorsman and runner, Pat O'Rourke ran a series of small border businesses, or maquilas, that drew on the cheap labor in Juarez. They all failed. What consumed him was politics. O'Rourke became county commissioner in 1978, and after building a new jail in the 1980s, won a race for county judge. In Texas, a management job rather than a courtroom role. He had married into relative wealth to Melissa Williams, whose family owned the high-end furniture store in town, Charlotte's. The O'Rourkes were among the first in El Paso to install a swimming pool. Pat O'Rourke was a garrulous carouser and a bit of a showboat, a fixture at the Cincinnati Bar and Grill, where local poobahs gathered to debate and drink. Beto O'Rourke would later use the same restaurant as his informal think tank when he first ran for office. He came under scrutiny for using government funds to outfit his office with furniture from his wife's store, and in 1983 he became embroiled in a controversy over a powdery substance, possibly cocaine or heroin, discovered in a condom found in his Toyota Land Cruiser. A sheriff's deputy destroyed the evidence before it could be analyzed. The incident was investigated by the DA's office, and the ensuing uproar, known thereafter as Rubbergate, became front-page news. The controversy tarnished his reputation, but it didn't dampen his enthusiasm. He became an avid supporter of the Reverend Jesse Jackson during both his 1984 and 1988 runs for president, and once held a reception for Jackson at the O'Rourke home. Young Beto posed for a picture with Jackson, which he still displays in his home. Pat O'Rourke was popular with everyone but his son, with whom he clashed from an early age. "My dad was very critical and had very high expectations, without a lot of the details filled in," says O'Rourke. "It was, 'I expect you to achieve greatness in grades, in athletics, in whatever you do.'" Beto O'Rourke has two younger sisters, Charlotte and Erin. "When he failed math one semester, my dad essentially stopped talking to me," he says. "He made it clear that I embarrassed him. That was just the most profoundly painful thing I had experienced up to that point." O'Rourke's mother tried softening the tension, but Beto felt like an appendage to his father's public persona. His dad once bought him a tandem bicycle and entered them in races without asking him. "I hated it. because it involved a lot of yelling at me, like, quit leaning to the right, goddammit, he recalls, and then just harrowing, just racing through an intersection, and he's got the brakes and the steering, and all I can do is just pedal my balls off and hope that we don't die. O'Rourke escaped into early computer chat rooms and made two close friends, Arlo Clar and Mike Stevens. They drew comic books, read underground fanzines, wrote poetry, skateboarded, and inspired by The Clash, took up guitar and went to local punk rock shows. They became devotees of the Washington, D.C. record label Discord, co-founded by Ian McKay, a punk firebrand who influenced a generation of disaffected suburban youth. I have so much reverence for him, and he means so much to me in my life, O'Rourke says of McKay. He really did represent this super ethical way, not just of being in a band, or running a label, or putting on shows, but of just living. The punk ethos, Ian McKay tells me, is for people who can't figure out how they're supposed to fit into society. And I think in many ways they're the right people. Beto O'Rourke was desperate to escape El Paso. I wanted out, he says. I wanted out of the house. I wanted away from him and his shadow. His father tried directing him to the New Mexico Military Institute, but O'Rourke instead applied to a prep school in Virginia called Woodbury Forest, on advice from his grandfather through marriage, Fred Korth, a former Secretary of the Navy in the Kennedy administration. As soon as he arrived, O'Rourke felt profoundly alienated from the preppy Southern boys and instead made friends with music heads and international students from Turkey and Korea. We were the weirdo table, he said. We were the rejects who just did not fit in culturally, money, social status. He listened to college radio, produced a research report on the U.S. overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz Guzman government in Guatemala, and helped found an environmental club called the Terra Interest Society. He ran track and field, but also deepened his devotion to punk. On his yearbook page, he quoted the Discord band Rites of Spring. I found a hidden wheel, and it rolls to reveal that I'm the angry son. I'm the angry son. O'Rourke says he didn't have his first sip of alcohol until he was 19 while at Columbia University, a school he had never heard of, until an older student, Bo Higgins, mentioned he was going. In the East, he called himself Robert instead of Beto. He grew his hair long and majored in film before switching to English. Neither idea pleased his father. He was like, you can read books on your own time, recounts O'Rourke. You can't learn how to be an accountant, or you can't learn how to be a doctor or an astrophysicist on your own. Use Columbia for that. One day, a gym teacher saw O'Rourke on the rowing machine and persuaded him to row crew. The sport fed an unmet desire in O'Rourke for discipline and purity. He became a monk. He says, moving into a solitary dorm room, getting up at 6 a.m. to train every day, and drinking protein shakes to gain weight. I would just start throwing up, and just forcing as many calories in, and then rowing in the morning, and lifting weights in the afternoon every day, he says. I really liked that. I really liked seeing myself get better, or seeing the boat get better, learning a skill, and a discipline I had never really understood or knew existed, being good at something. He remembered feeling ecstatic when he beat Harvard. You win the other boat's shirts, and so I brought that shirt home, gave it to my dad, he says. His single-minded devotion to crew and to the purifying energy of punk rock foreshadowed his future political self. In the summer of 1991, however, when O'Rourke's father signed him up for an internship with West Texas Congressman Ron Coleman, O'Rourke had no interest and did it only to please his father. He used the time in D.C. to see Fugazi, the band fronted by his hero, Ian McKay. He and his El Paso friends, Arlo Klar and Mike Stevens, formed Foss, the Icelandic word for waterfall, and after recording their first album, the El Paso Pussycats organized a month-long tour. Conscripting El Paso drummer Cedric Bixler-Zavala, later a member of a successful indie group at the drive-in, and driving across the U.S. and Canada in a station wagon. It was a grand adventure, but also a lesson in scrappy survival. O'Rourke was unusually resourceful. Frustrated by a series of shows that didn't materialize, he called up a popular rock venue in San Francisco and altered his voice, pretending to be a founder of Sub Pop, a famous indie rock label. He urged them to book Foss as the opening act, claiming the band was about to be signed to a record deal. They got on the bill but were kicked off the stage after two songs. Former girlfriends describe O'Rourke as curious, wry, bookish but adventurous. He usually carried a novel in his pocket, whether Captain Corelli's Mandolin or The Sun Also Rises. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.